You may be surprised to hear that buildings built before 1920 typically use less energy than just about anything built since then. And that's just one of the many reasons we may want to take a closer look at the way today's buildings are put together. Welcome to GBA Radio.
This podcast series is excerpted from a two-day seminar on building science fundamentals taught by Dr. Joe Stiebrick and Dr. John Straub of Building Science Corporation. For information on attending a live class, go to buildingscienceseminars.com.
In our last show, Dr. Joe discussed a real-world example of poor indoor air quality. This week, Dr. John puts our energy and resource demands into perspective and wonders why we've let them get to the state they're in.
This is going to be an issue that's going to affect how you do your business and how you live your life in the next little while. So we're going to talk about the connection between green building, sustainability, building science, and maybe we'll come to a little bit of an understanding on what, when we're talking about green buildings, what we need, why we would want to go there, and how you'd want to go about doing it in a broad sense. So why do we worry about green buildings? Well, the first thing is that buildings consume a lot of resources, and I think most of us know that, but they don't realize the extent to which buildings consume a lot of resources. It's the most consumptive kind of industry on the planet. We use more resources and are a larger dollar value than the automotive industry combined with the aerospace industry. We use more energy than pretty much any other industry that you can put your finger at. The reason we don't notice this as much is that it's a very disaggregated industry. So some of the largest home builders might have turnovers of a few billion dollars, but there's only a few of them, and there's tens of thousands of people who are working at the smaller level. And so unlike the Boeings and the Airbus industries, which there's only a few companies that dominate, in the construction and building industry, there are tens and hundreds of thousands of relatively small companies, and we don't realize the impact. Now, they consume a lot of money, consume a lot of resources, consume a lot of energy, and they also pollute, displace, and destroy habitat. It's pretty obvious when you pave over a farmland and put in a strip mall, you've displaced some sort of habitat. Now, how much we can continue doing that is, of course, arguable, but it's not arguable that they do displace habitat. We also have to recognize that they're a durable good. So when we complain about, say, the energy content of a pair of running shoes or a laptop computer, that is a problem that can be fixed fairly quickly. It doesn't consume a major part of your household income to buy running shoes. And if the running shoes that you purchase are badly built of environmentally inappropriate materials, within 1 year you have to get a new pair of running shoes anyway. So you can fix the problem and we can react to the crises. When you build a building, you have created a liability for society for the next at least 20 years, maybe 100 years. Or you've provided an asset for society for the next 20 to 100 years. Depends what you've delivered. And this is why there's a lot more codes and standards related to buildings, is that they last a long time. So a median life for a building might be something like 35 years. Halfway through its life would be 35 years. And that's why, of course, when we do our energy calculations and we try and figure out, so what kind of insulation should we put in the wall, we of course use the energy price for 35 years from now. That would be the rational approach to saying, so if you're going to make a product that lasts 70 years, we would obviously do our economic calculations based on what the energy would be in 35 years, right? That's what a rational economist would do. Do we do that? Of course not. In fact, we haven't been doing that for the last 35 years. Since the Department of Energy's Energy Information Agency started reporting data and making projections about energy, they have never once been right. They have always underpredicted the cost of energy because most of the time they assume energy increases at the rate of inflation. And in the last 30 years, it's more than double that. A rate of inflation for energy, depending if you're talking electric, natural gas, or oil, is in the order of 7-8% per year compounded. If you use those types of analysis and look at the lifespan of 35 to 70 years, you come up with completely different answers than what the code is. The code is, of course, a minimum, right? But in, let's say, in Massachusetts, putting R40 in an attic doesn't make economic sense. Economically, knowing what we know today, continuing a straight line projection of energy prices as they've increased over the last 35 years, R40 wouldn't make economic sense. And yet, we put in R40. And commercial buildings, as Joe described, with the R2 window wall kind of enclosure for a condominium or an office building, it doesn't make any sense today with today's energy prices in a almost no payback period. Most of the time, you can pay that back just by saving on mechanical costs. So the lifespan that we look at in buildings is quite different. And that isn't the only problem. We don't even look at it properly in today's prices. So all of these things say that buildings are becoming an increasing focus if you look at environment beyond our building industry. Recently, the auto industry has had this bill passed where they're going to have to increase their fleet fuel efficiency from the low 20s to 35 miles per gallon. And yet, the auto industry is not the biggest producer of CO2. It is not the largest consumer of energy. The building industry is. And eventually, someone's going to figure out that the building industry needs to get regulated and we need to deliver what's possible technically and economically. I'll show you some numbers that people are starting to recognize this and are starting to notice that the building industry is the one that is out of sync with the rest of the world. So that's why insulation standards are very likely to increase, mechanical equipment standards are likely to increase, and being able to answer to the demands for better buildings is likely to increase. So I think we've all seen the images and the statistics about energy consumption and resource consumption of buildings. 35 to 50% of all energy consumed, depending on the country, is used in operation and production of buildings. It's about 40% in North America. Because it's such a large industry, we do produce pollution when we're generating the building materials, when we're actually making the building itself. We also make big holes in the ground and chop down forests. The good thing about chopping down forests is that people notice it and it looks ugly. And so they've actually been campaigns for 20 years to reduce the wanton chopping down of forests. And the wood industry has actually risen to the challenge of providing more wood today than there was 10 years ago. There's more standing wood almost every year in the last 15 years in America than there was the previous year. The challenge has gone from providing enough wood to providing good biodiversity, rainwater runoff and erosion, and they're moving towards that. It's easier to hide large holes in the ground where people are mining iron ore or cement because they're kind of localized, only a few square miles, and people don't usually hike through them. But those industries are also starting to respond. And we definitely have to think about how communities are put together, because communities and how they're put together are probably as important as the building enclosure mechanical system kind of package. 2/3 of all the electricity in America is consumed in buildings, and that's pretty important because the electricity is also the most pollution-intensive form. People see electricity as some sort of clean energy source. It isn't in North America. We could make it clean, but we're not there yet. Right now, electricity is the dirtiest form of power, and so we're always trying to minimize it the most and use it the most efficiently. Purchased energy in buildings alone has almost $500 billion this year, will be in 2008. $500 billion a year. You could wage a major war in some far-off country for that kind of money. 750 million tons of carbon dioxide, which is a pretty large source of CO2. It's 40% of the U.S. total, and almost a little over 8% of the world's CO2 comes from American buildings. That's a pretty big number right there. And of course, it's the largest source of sulfur dioxide, which produces acid rain and so on. Now, we talked about the R values over 1,000 years with a couple of case studies. You know, simple buildings, look at it, and you're saying, okay, well, those are just case studies. What is the whole building stock doing? Well, every 3 years, the Department of Energy does a comprehensive survey of commercial and institutional buildings. 10,000 of them is the normal sample size. And they ask all kinds of questions about what happens in that building, how many people use it, where it's built, size, date, etc. And they collect the energy use in 2003. So if you were to know nothing else about a commercial building when you purchased it, other than its age, then the lowest energy building would either be buildings built before 1920 or buildings built in 2000 to 2003, brand new buildings. And this is not because buildings built before 1920 don't have computers in them. When you drive downtown Boston, you'll see lots of 1920s buildings have lights and elevators and air conditioning, all that kind of modern convenience features. This is the energy used in 2003. The difference is that the building enclosure and the building systems used in these older buildings were inherently more energy efficient. And one of the reasons they were inherently more energy efficient wasn't because people in 1920 were smart. It's because energy was much more expensive in 1920. We seem to forget that. Energy costs in New York City and Chicago at the turn of the century were, you know, depending on the type of energy you're talking about, were double, triple, quadruple what we pay today. Electricity was quadruple the cost, and heating your building with coal was around double the cost of what it is today. So those buildings were actually more economically sensible than many of the buildings we build today, even though today we have lots of interesting technologies that allow us to dramatically reduce this number. So this number here is showing 80,000 BTUs per square foot per year, and that's an energy metric that you can actually measure on your own building. You can figure out how much gas you use, how much electricity you use, convert it into BTUs, and then divide by the square footage. That's how complicated this is. And many buildings, you know, good buildings are in the 30s. You can build buildings in the 30s that don't cost a lot. So Ed Masria, how many people here have heard of Ed Masria? Usually the architects have heard of Ed Masria because he's an architect, did a lot of work in the 70s on passive solar design, and then he went back into the hills when oil prices dropped to 10 bucks. And then in the last few years, he's come back out of the hills and been on this campaign of saying that architecture has the major role to play in controlling climate change because of the energy impacts. And one of the things he's got is that, well, architecture is more than just the buildings, it affects cities. There are parts of the industrial complex where the office spaces and so on, they're affected by the architecture, and therefore, but if you add all those components together, he figures about 50% of all of the energy consumption in the United States is somewhat under the label of architecture. And more disturbingly, he finds that the CO2 emissions of buildings has risen faster than any other segment. Industry actually has sort of flattened out. It was on a similar trend to transportation and buildings until somewhere in the 70s. It's funny, somewhere around 1973 to 75, there was a major change in how industry was emitting CO2. Huh, wonder what that might have been. And that was, of course, the first oil crisis, as they called it. And then the next oil crisis in 79, well, that then finally industry had it, and they said, okay, the writing's on the wall, energy prices are going to be expensive, we're going to have to do something about it. And what they did was people started counting. They had people who figured out how much energy each process used, went around and made life cycle cost decisions on using premium efficiency motors and when we should insulate. And the energy consumed has pretty much stayed flat since that time. Largely, but not exclusively, largely through energy efficiency measures. The same effect has not happened in buildings because people do not have rational decision makers when they design buildings. Nobody's actually saying, so how much energy am I going to use? Well, what is the 10-year payback or the 12-year payback on this choice of this electric motor for a fan versus that electric motor for a fan? And because they don't make those decisions, our energy consumption continues to go up. It's a similar problem in transportation. Trucks have gotten more energy efficient, trains have gotten more energy efficient, and planes have gotten more energy efficient. Personal automobiles have gotten less efficient because people who purchase personal automobiles don't make rational economic choices. How else do you explain people driving Suburbans to work? You know, the odds of you needing to seat 12 people or pull a stump out on the way home from work seems pretty low. And rationally, you probably would just rent such a vehicle the one day in 3 years you need to do so. So those irrational decisions explain both the rate of increase in transportation and in buildings. It's not about that it doesn't make economic or good business sense. In the residential sector, there were some pretty major improvements made in energy efficiency, unlike in the commercial segment. And they were made because of regulation. And before 1950, houses used a lot of energy. And over time, especially the heating, the space heating went down, air conditioning went up, appliances were staying about constant. But major changes in water heating and space heating. And that trend dropped or ended in the 1990s. In the 1990s, our energy consumption per household went back up again. And there's a couple of reasons for this. One is that the code stopped enforcing tighter regulations in the 80s. So in the 90s, the result came home to roost. The second thing was that it was larger homes. People continued to build larger and larger buildings, and those larger buildings obviously consume more energy. Even though the household size is still a household, it's got more square footage. So again, it's not because we can't make more energy efficient buildings. It's not because it doesn't make economic sense. It's because we haven't chosen to.
Tune in next week when Dr. John talks about where our energy comes from and how those sources have changed through the years.
GBA Radio is a production of greenbuildingadvisor.com. Thanks for listening.